scenes from a weekend of protests and celebration after the Supreme Court ruled Friday to overturn the constitutional right to abortion. So far, at least 9 states have already banned the procedure, with few exceptions. One of them is Texas. That state already had a law in effect that banned the procedure after a fetal heartbeat could be detected around 6 weeks. And that law allows citizens to sue anyone in the state who helps a pregnant person get an abortion. Well, now abortion is almost entirely banned, even in cases of rape and incest. The only exception is for the life of the mother, and the punishment for performing the procedure is life in prison and up to a $100,000 fine. Well, that is the maximum possible sentence. Molly Hennessy Fisk is the Houston Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, and she spent some time inside Alamo Women's Reproductive Services in San Antonio. And she joins us now to talk more about that. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you were there on Friday, just before the court released its opinion. What was the reaction inside the clinic?
That's right. So we had showed up before the clinic even opened. There were people waiting outside to come in. There were protesters at the entrance to the parking lot. For them, they just thought it was a normal day. The protesters were aware that the ruling might come down, but the patients who are coming in were not. So we went in to talk to Dr. Alan Braid, who's the longtime owner of the clinic. He is 77. He had started work pre-Roe doing abortions. And so I was back in his office talking to him with my colleague, a photographer, when the office manager, who's his daughter, came in and said the court just ruled it was a full overturn. And so then they had to sort of rush off and consult with lawyers to see if they could keep working, because technically Texas's Republican attorney general came out pretty quickly and said, no, we believe that the pre-Roe abortion ban that existed before the ruling even happened back in 1973 takes effect now, and these are the penalties. So then the doctor and the staff had to come out and explain to the women that they couldn't do abortions for them, and tried to give them referrals to other places.
And how did the women react to that?
So first of all, they were kind of shocked. And I should say, during the time when the staff and the doctor were consulting lawyers, an anti-abortion protester actually came in and said she had an announcement to make that Roe had been overturned and abortion was now illegal. And so then the women were really confused, and a staffer came and chased the protester out because that person was technically trespassing. They're not allowed to come onto the property. And then the staffer explained to the women that they were kind of on hold waiting to hear. And then the doctor came out and explained what the law was. And some of the women were pretty upset. A couple of them had traveled like 8 hours or plus driving from Oklahoma, because Oklahoma had passed restrictive laws that functionally stopped all the clinics there from doing abortions even before Roe was overturned. And so they were saying, well, wait a minute, I just traveled. I just took time off from work. I have a couple kids. What am I supposed to do now? And the clinic was referring them to New Mexico, and they were saying that's like a full day's drive. Then some of the ones who were from Texas were just trying to find out if they could either go to New Mexico, or a lot of them were interested in seeing if they could get abortion medication by mail. But all of this stuff takes time, and the clock was ticking for them in terms of, you know, how pregnant they were.
Oh my gosh. So there was nothing really the clinic could do for them. They could just give them these referrals and that's it.
Yeah, there was concern because in the law that existed before Roe was overturned, SB 8, which you had mentioned, the Texas law that took effect in September, there are civil penalties where people could get sued for aiding and abetting people getting abortions within the state of Texas beyond the limits of that law, like you said, about 6 weeks fetal cardiac activity. So I think there was concern, too, that they had to be careful. The clinic had to be careful about what the information they provided, what they told women was possible. So mostly they were trying to refer them to other places. There was a woman who came in with her husband, an Indian American woman, who said they were traveling back to India in a couple of days, and she was really desperate. She was begging the staff to do the abortion because they didn't think that they would have time to travel. They had 3 kids. The youngest was 7 months old. The kids were out in the minivan in the parking lot with the husband. And the staff just had to keep telling her, I'm sorry, but we can't break the law.
What's going to happen now to the clinic? The clinic, I guess, could provide abortions in case the woman's life is in danger, but that's about it, right?
Yeah, they can do things like for ectopic pregnancies, or if someone, like they had a patient who came who had already taken a medication abortion and it hadn't been fully complete, but there was no heartbeat, so it wasn't a viable pregnancy, so they were able to like finish that and complete it with a surgical abortion. They were doing follow-up appointments with women who'd already gotten medication abortion just to make sure it worked, because in a certain percentage of cases, a small percentage, but sometimes it doesn't work. And so those women would have to get referred out of state as well. So technically, they're staying open for the moment. They're thinking about moving to a state that doesn't have restrictive abortion laws, like New Mexico, Colorado, maybe tribal land, although, again, the legality of that is kind of up in the mm-hmm. air, whether they'd be able to do that. So they're trying to figure that out. They did the same doctor owns another clinic in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And so they've been through this already, both in Oklahoma and in Texas. Their clinic in Tulsa stopped doing abortions, but is technically still open because they want to be there to refer women to other places, give them the information they need to figure out what they can do.
And so are some of these women considering going across the border to Mexico?
Earlier this year, I was down in the Rio Grande Valley and talking to women at the only abortion clinic that's there on the border. There was one in El Paso, but it's like 800 miles away. So the women at that McAllen clinic, they were very aware that you could cross the border and legally buy misoprostol and bring it back to the United States again legally. But they had concerns about it. They were worried, like, if they took it and had complications. They said they wanted to come to a clinic to get treated by a doctor to make sure they were doing it right. Plus, when you go to a clinic, you get two drugs, mifepristone and misoprostol. Now, it can work if you just take the one, but the two-drug protocol is seen by some as more effective. And again, you're getting it from a clinic, from clinic staff with a follow-up. You also get all sorts of strange advice on how to take it. One guy at a pharmacy told me to take one pill every hour for 6 hours and then jump up and down to expel the embryo, which is just totally incorrect. And the doctor I talked to at the abortion clinic on the U.S. side said that she hears that all the time from patients, that they've been given incorrect advice, and so then the medication doesn't work and they end up going to the clinic. She also said she's seen patients come in who got this shot in Mexico, methotrexate, which actually is a medicine that used to be used to induce abortions back in the 1960s in the U.S., but it isn't commonly used anymore, in part because if it doesn't work, it can cause birth defects. And she said the patient she's seen who got it told her that the folks who gave it to them in Mexico said, if you have any concerns or problems, go see the abortion clinic on the Texas side. And she felt like that was pretty irresponsible, that there was mm-hmm. no follow-up care being provided. They were counting on her. And now, of course, her clinic is closed. So what's going to happen to women who go and get that shot or get pills in Mexico and then have side effects?
Wow. So many questions and so much uncertainty now and in the foreseeable future. Molly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Hennessy-Fisk, Houston Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Well, as we just heard, people can go to Mexico to get abortion medication. They can order it by mail, too. And Attorney General Merrick Garland said after the ruling that states may not ban mifepristone based on disagreement with the FDA's expert judgment about its safety and efficacy. That's a direct quote. So what does this mean for abortion pills in states where abortion is now banned? Joining us is attorney and abortion rights activist Kate Kelly. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So for the first time, it was during the pandemic that the FDA allowed people to get abortion pills via telemedicine. So talk a little bit about the rules now in place for medication abortions.
Yeah, so the FDA suspended the requirement that the pill mifepristone, which is one of two pills used for the medication abortion, be dispensed in person. And so before that, people would have to go into a doctor's office and take the pill in front of the doctor and then go home. The actual abortion and everything that happens later has always been done at home and you always took the second group of pills at home. So really, the lifting of the in-person dispensing requirement hasn't changed much, because the person meets with the doctor on a telehealth visit and they just take the pill at home.
Okay, so let's talk about this potential conflict, because even before Friday's Supreme Court handing down that announcement, a decision overturning Roe, 19 states had already banned telehealth visits for abortions. So what could possibly happen now? Would the states have precedence over the FDA when it comes to this issue?
Yeah. So I think it's important to remember that people will keep getting abortions no matter what, whether or not they are legal. And medication abortion is one of the easiest and least expensive ways to do that, especially if you live in a rural area or have a hard time traveling. And so whether or not these states try to ban taking a medication that is FDA approved, people are going to keep getting the pills, and you can get them from Aid Access. It's a group actually that if you live in a place where it has banned medication abortion or the provision of these pills, you can meet with a doctor in Europe. So you can have a telehealth visit with a doctor in Europe. Obviously, they cannot prosecute doctors in Europe. They're not bringing anyone from the Netherlands on charges. Mm-hmm. And so people can meet with those doctors and get the pills sent to them. They're very, very tiny. So if you can get a letter in the mail, you can get an abortion in any state.
But could the state then prosecute the person who has the telehealth visit with the provider in another country or another state?
Most of the bills try to target the providers and not the pregnant people, because they know that pregnant people are obviously more sympathetic and they don't want to target people who, you know, other people are going to find sympathetic. And so most of the bills target the providers. In the case where they do target the people, it is not possible to find out in any sort of test whether or not you took the pills if you're miscarrying. So it's very, very rare. But if you took the pills and had to go to the hospital, you can just simply say that you're having a miscarriage, and there is no way for them to know whether or not you took the pills.
So I guess there's a lot of focus too on digital tracking, and maybe some people are worried that if they do even a Google search for this, mm-hmm. they might be tracked by state authorities and possibly prosecuted. Is that something that they should fear?
I think privacy, online privacy, is extremely important, especially when it comes to your healthcare information, and people should be careful. But keep in mind that most of these laws are completely unenforceable. It is not possible for existing law enforcement to investigate and track down every person who's Googled abortion pills in mm-hmm. any of these states. So the point of these laws is actually to scare people, to create a fear in the community so that we do not help each other find information, and also so that people will be scared away from accessing healthcare, which is their human right. So it's really not conceivable or possible that they could actually prosecute all these people. But what is possible is for them to create fear. And so I think they'll be very successful in the latter, but not the former.
Right. So if taking the example of these women in this Texas clinic we were just hearing about in the previous mm-hmm. segment, what could they do to seek an abortion in this way that would be that they could easily do?
Yeah. So again, Aid Access is a way that you can get the pills and have them mailed to you. You can also get the pills advanced provision. So Aid Access provides pills even if you're not pregnant. You can get the abortion pills and you can have them on hand. That applies to people who also can't get pregnant. If you can't get pregnant, you might know someone who can. And you can get these pills in advance. Again, if you can get a letter in the mail, you can get an abortion and you can help other people get access to this medicine. It's very important to be discreet, of course, especially in a place like Texas, and people should take those precautions. But medication abortion is completely completely safe. It's done already, even before the Dobbs decision, over 50% of abortions in the United States were done by medication abortion, by just taking these two types of pills. So it's really safe. People do need to keep their information private and be extra careful about that. But we won't stop having abortions. And this is one of the ways they can do so without physical risk or without traveling.
Because technically what they would be doing is illegal, right?
Depending on the state, technically.
In Texas, using our example.
Yeah.
Or any of the other states that have banned abortion or restricted telemedicine. In this way.
Exactly. Yeah. But SB 8, keep in mind, is up to 6 weeks. So people can still get abortions in a lot of these places that have bans. The bans are after a certain period of weeks. It may be doing something that is not legal, but I think we need to move away from that framework entirely. When the Supreme Court bans something that is a basic fundamental human right, they have no legitimacy. And so people will keep having abortions, whether legal or not. What we need to do is help them do it safely.
I have heard that there are clinics being set up along the borders to provide telemedicine appointments and visits and the medication abortion.
Of course.
Have you seen that happening?
Yeah. So there are, in a lot of states, there are clinics being set up very close to borders to make it easier for people in restricting states to get access to that care. They have to just go across the state line and get the medication or have the procedure. And yes, that is definitely happening and should happen. Of course, some of these states are trying to ban travel. They're talking about trying to ban interstate travel for these procedures, which is unfathomable and clearly unconstitutional. But as we have seen, they don't care about that. And they don't actually care about long pre-existing constitutional rights. So yeah, they'll do anything they can and they'll stop at nothing to try to keep people from getting the care they need. But it is important to emphasize how safe and common and quotidian this medication is. It's widely available and very, very safe.
Kay Kelly is a human rights attorney and author of the book Ordinary Equality, The Fearless Women and Queer People Who Shaped the U.S. Constitution and the Equal Rights Amendment. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the Supreme Court is not done issuing landmark opinions. Today, the court sided with a high school football coach who wanted to pray on the 50-yard line. How the court is blurring the line between church and state, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. While Americans grapple with the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, the court is issuing important rulings in other cases this week. Today, the conservative justices sided with a high school football coach who led prayers on the field after a game. By a vote of 6-3, the court ruled the coach has a right to openly express his religion at a public high school. The ruling follows another case last week in which the conservative justices allowed religious schools to receive state funding. Jessica Levinson is a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle on Press Play. Hi. Jessica,
Happy last Monday of the Supreme Court term.
Hello. Well, we have you now. Sorry for the delay. So it has been less than a week since that decision came down. Similar reasoning. This one was written by Justice Neil Gorsuch.
In my mind, very similar reasoning. What we have here is a Supreme Court that's looking at religious objectors. So it's looking at people who say my religious rights are violated, and by and large, really giving them very big wins. Now, as we talked about last week, there was the case of Maine, where they provided public funds for children to go to either other public schools where they had to travel or to private schools. And the court said, it actually discriminates against religion if you don't let those public funds go to religious schools. Here, The court's saying something very similar, which is we have this high school football coach. He wants to pray at the 50-yard line. And the court says if we don't let him pray, we are in fact violating his religious beliefs. We're violating the free exercise clause and we're discriminating against religion. In both cases, a lot more concern for being able to freely exercise your religious rights than for being free from government interference of religion.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what about the students who were there and or the football players who then were praying around him or were expected to pray around him? What did the court say about them?
So there was the first thing to start with is the idea that there was actually a lot of disagreement about the facts between the majority and the dissent. So the majority is saying, we're talking about this high school football coach who doesn't give up all of his First Amendment rights just because he has decided to coach a public high school team. And so what they said is that his prayer actually was not public speech, which could be limited. It was private speech. It was his private personal beliefs, even though he was in the uniform, even though he was at the field. They said these are somewhat silent, sometimes silent, but private moments. Then we have the majority saying, I'm looking at what's happening here. I'm looking at the number of students around him, the number of players around him. This looks like government endorsed speech to me. This looks like public speech. And so as to this question about coercion, the majority of the court, the conservative majority is saying, we're not worried about it. He's entitled to basically stand to the side or stand at the mid-yard line and have a quiet moment of prayer. And if people want to join him, they can, but we can't discriminate against him just because some people might want to join or feel awkward about not joining. The dissent is saying this is coercion. Of course, he's the high school football coach. The students are joining him. How are you going to feel if you're not religious or if you're a member of another religion?
And how is this private if this was on the 50-yard line?
This was a moment of huge disagreement between the majority and the dissent, where there was a very large, it's called factual record, basically. There was a huge number of facts in this case. It's actually the second time it's gone up to the court. And the majority was really focusing on the initial times that the high school coach had prayed. As I read it, the times where he really did kind of go to the side for a moment, he wasn't surrounded by students. The dissent is saying we need to look at the totality of what happened here. And he was joined by many students. This did become ultimately, I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but a spectacle. And it was fascinating to see, looking at the same set of events, really, I think the majority focusing very narrowly on just the beginning of the case and the dissent saying, let's broaden out for a minute and look at everything that has happened, and including really large displays. And so how could this be private? The majority says, just because you decide to work for a public school or work for the government in general, it doesn't mean that you give up all of your religious beliefs. It doesn't mean that you can't have private moments in the snack room, in, you know, at a lunch break. And they basically equate this to a snack room or a lunch break.
Hmm. So what are the larger ramifications then? What is happening when it comes to sort of the larger issue of the expression of religion in the public or the semi-public sphere?
So the first thing I'll say is what this doesn't mean. This does not mean that we are now endorsing school prayer. This does not mean that you walk into a classroom and your public school teacher can say, and before we get to geography, let's all bow our heads and say the Lord's Prayer. And if you don't want to join, okay. What the court is saying is that that is very different. Now, it might not feel as different for me or for other people, but what we see going forward is that if there is a moment to find that a government employee is not speaking for the government, but is instead using their own personal private time and beliefs and engaging in some sort of religious activity, but I think this court will basically latch on to that and then will say we need to be extremely careful about discriminating against that person. this court is really not particularly, in my mind, nearly as concerned as maybe other justices or the justices in the dissent about establishment, meaning the government supports religion or the government supports one religion over another.
Well, interesting, because the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause in the First Amendment both seem to be at odds in this particular decision with these, with the dissent and the majority.
Well, and the majority goes to pains to say, actually, they're complementary. There's no tension here. They're both pointing in the same direction. They're both trying to strike this balance between protecting people in their exercise of religion and protecting us from too much government interference in religion. And the dissent is saying, what on earth are you doing to the Establishment Clause? You are in so many different ways saying the government gets to be part of our religious sphere. And the idea that this coach, again, in his uniform, around all the students, that he cannot be told you need to pray somewhere else or at some other time, the dissent is very worried about that.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the musician Leonard Cohen and his song Hallelujah, how it went from being initially dismissed to becoming an enduring anthem.
Dylan recognizing it, I think, validated Leonard's belief in that song. And that ultimately led to a path that no one could have predicted, John Cale to Buckley to Shrek.
A new documentary about the making of Hallelujah, next on Press Play.
Now I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you?
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled.
Leonard Cohen singing his most famous song, Hallelujah, an anthem for the spiritual, for the secular, for the skeptic, the hopeful romantic, the forlorn victim of heartbreak. When that song came out in 1984, it was a flop. It wasn't even released in the United States initially. But the song received a second act when Jeff Buckley covered it on the only album he released before he died when he was just 30. Then Hallelujah received a third act in the animated fairy tale classic Shrek, with versions by both John Cale and Rufus Wainwright.
Hallelujah.
A new documentary tells the story of the song and Cohen's career. It's called Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen, A Journey, A Song. And it's directed by Dana Goldfein and Dan Geller. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Great to have you. Okay, so before we get to the song and dissecting it, let's just get a backgrounder on Leonard Cohen and where he was at his career at that point, because 1984, that was a fallow period for Leonard Cohen, but he had been on the scene for decades, right?
Yeah, he started out as a poet and a novelist, actually, and was kind of discovered and lauded across Canada starting in the late 50s. And then he announced to the world sort of in the mid-60s that he didn't want to just identify as a poet and a novelist, but he actually wanted to be a singer-songwriter. And he went to New York and at age 32 was told he was way too old. But Judy Collins heard Suzanne and said it was a song. And then she encouraged Leonard to get on stage and sing it with her. And then he started recording, and he had a career that was much more successful in Europe and Canada, and was just kind of, you know, fumfering along here in the United States. So that by 1984, the new head of Columbia Records, Walter Yetnikoff, sort of threw the gauntlet down and said, this is a make or break album. You know, if we don't think it can sell in America, it's the end of your career with Columbia.
Well, just to put it in context, 1984, we've got Michael Jackson's Thriller, we've got Madonna, and then there's Leonard Cohen. I just want to play a clip of tape of him talking about what happened when he put out this album and the Columbia Records head, as you mentioned, Walter Yetnikoff, his reaction. And here is Leonard Cohen describing his meeting with Walter Yetnikoff and the reaction.
I visited the chief executive of Columbia Records.
And?
First of all, he reviewed my suit. Then he said, Leonard, we know you're great, but we don't know if you're any good.
Well, that's stinging. What does that mean, though? Great, but not good.
I think probably a recognition that Leonard was, even at that time, one of the great poet, singer, songwriters. If you just look at it from an artistic, intellectual, spiritual level, but maybe not any good in terms of record sales. And that's the, at least as I parse it, that may well be what Yetnikoff meant by that comment. I can't imagine it the other way around, that Yetnikoff would have thought Leonard was just, you know, decent as a songwriter, but great in terms of album sales.
So as we just said, the album was pretty much a dud. I just want to get into the creation now of this song and how it came to be. Because as you recounted in your movie, he worked on it for a long time. Why did he just work and work and work on this particular song? What was it to him?
Well, you know, he actually worked on all of his songs for a really long time. There's a point in the film where he compares himself to Bob Dylan, who was known for probably half in jest saying that it took him 15 minutes to write certain ones of his songs. And Leonard was very quick to say that, unfortunately, in his life, that was not the case. So we think, based on the notebooks that we've seen, there's five of them that span the years during which he was working on Hallelujah. We think it took him about 7 years. And as he said, he liked to, or didn't like to, but he struggled with the process of blackening pages. I think that that song covers every subject that fascinated Leonard Cohen, whether it was spiritual or carnal, as you so eloquently laid it out in your intro. It had everything in it, and I think because he grappled with all of those things every day of his life, that song was something that he needed to spend years on.
Here is a clip, as you mentioned, all the notebooks where he had all these different versions, and here is a clip of him talking about that.
Okay, here. When David played, his fingers bled. He wept for every word he said. You hear him still. You hear him singing to you. Endless variations. Even here, it said, baby, I've been here before. I know what rooms like this are for. Baby, I've been here before. I know this room, this crooked floor. And baby, I've been here before. I know this room. I've walked this floor. I mean, these are all the Hallelujah songs.
How many are there?
Well, just taken as two separate recordings by Leonard himself, you've got the version from 1984, what he calls the King David version, much in the way of the Old Testament references in the lyrics. And then he started singing a secular version of the song years later because he felt that he wanted to broaden the reach of the Hallelujah itself. And of the four original verses in that original recording, three got tossed out, and he put in four brand new ones to make a five-verse song that had more secular preoccupations. So starting with Leonard himself, you know, there are different versions of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, much less other verses that people were able to get hold of, such as John Cale mixing the spiritual and the religious versions of the songs.
And, you know, throughout his life, Leonard mixed and matched those seven verses every night, almost, depending on how he felt. I mean, you know, there were a couple that he sang every single time, no matter what city he was in, but he really did mix and match those seven verses.
So when it comes out, does he go on tour to support it? How does it become the song that it is today in terms of everybody clamoring to play it and to hear it?
They didn't really tour that album. just a little bit, but it wasn't a big tour. I think what happened is that Bob Dylan had heard the song and started to sing it in some of his own concerts live. And that then began the slow ascent of this song, so that Dylan recognizing it, I think Leonard says in the movie, validated Leonard's belief in that song. It felt good to have someone of Dylan's stature singing the song. And that ultimately led Leonard to a path that no one could have predicted, as you mentioned, that John Cale to Buckley to Shrek and on onward from there.
But I think the biggest leap forward before Jeff Buckley, who took it into the stratosphere, but really happened when there was the cover album of Leonard Cohen's songs, I'm Your Fan. And when John Cale got involved in that project and chose to sing Hallelujah, and Leonard was kind enough to fax John Cale a certain number of verses and sort of said, mix and match it to your delight. And I think the John Cale version on the I'm Your Fan album, which came out around 1991, was the beginning of Hallelujah's inexorable march towards what we think of it as today.
Well, let's hear a bit of that. John Cale covering Hallelujah.
Her faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. The beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to a kitchen chair. She broke your throne, she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah. Hallelujah.
So just talking about the lyrics there, is he referring to Samson? Is he referring to himself? What's going on in that verse?
Yes. yes to all of it. I think that's what makes the song so deep and everlasting. Those lyrics are they're packed and with meaning and reference, and they're cryptic and they're completely wide open at the same time. And you can take them in any different ways. Yes, I think he's making some direct references that way. Yes, he's talking about himself. Yes, he's asking an audience to think about their own longing and carnality and the exaltation that one can get through a romantic connection and a sexual connection.
Okay, let's hear the Jeff Buckley version now.
Well, maybe there's a God above, but all I've ever learned from love was how to shoot somebody who I do. And it's not a cry that you hear at night. It's not somebody who's seen the light. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
It's so interesting to hear the different versions. Why is this one the one that most people know?
I think there was something about, I mean, Steve Berkowitz, who's the Columbia A&R guy who initially signed Jeff Buckley to that contract, says it the most succinctly. You know, he says what Jeff brought to that song was this younger, maybe overtly sexier version of a singer. And the people who had sung it before that were, you know, Leonard himself, Bob Dylan, and John Cale. And as Steve Berkowitz says, you know, they were kind of these dark, older male voices. And then along comes this smashingly handsome guy with an angelic voice. And then, as fate would have it, he has this tragically young death, which shocked everyone in the world and broke everyone's heart. And in some ways, although it couldn't be proven, there's this sense that that combination of his figure, the figure that Jeff Buckley struck out in the world, and then his untimely tragic death led to a certain prominence for Hallelujah.
It's interesting because he told MTV in 1995 that he didn't want Leonard Cohen to hear it.
And what was the question?
That Leonard Cohen. Do you know whether he's heard?
I hope he never hears it. Because I don't know. It sounds more, to me, sounds more like a boy singing it.
What do you make of that?
I look, to walk in Leonard's shoes, I think it's a pretty tough thing to do. And to cover that song and all of the depth and heft that it has, it has to be intimidating. And also coming right on the heels of John Cale doing it and Bob Dylan doing it. I disagree with his own concern and self-assessment. I do think he doesn't sound like a boy. He sounds like some otherworldly figure that is connected to parts of the song.
And honestly, Jeff Buckley's version was the first version I can remember hearing, at least the first version where, you know, I was at a friend's house and it came on in the background while we were having dinner, and I stopped what I was doing and said, "What is that?" And it wasn't until later that I realized that Leonard Cohen. So I'm one of those people. There's a short little sequence in our film where one person after another indicates that Jeff Buckley's version was the first version for them, and I'm guilty of the same.
So we talked a little bit about the lyrics, about how they are a mix of the spiritual and the profane, of direct references to the Bible and direct references to Cohen's personal life. But I want to talk about the music. And he collaborated with a genius producer named John Lissauer. And here's a little clip from that.
I could see how great it was. And as soon as I sat at the piano and we started to do... again, kind of a gospel 6/8 feel, which eventually is... favorite spot is the big hole in the end where it goes. The last time through it, really just you say, "Oh, please do something." Ugh.
So, how much of this song is a collaboration when it comes to the music between these two men?
They started out on an album years before. And I think John would be very careful about this because John knows of Leonard's brilliance and also that Leonard is a good musician and is a good songwriter. But I think what John did understand is that Leonard was looking for new sounds. He was always looking for new sounds, and that there would be an interesting contrast between the conventional instruments in the orchestrations and some synthetic organs and so forth that would give a different texture.
How did Leonard Cohen feel about all of these people covering this song?
You know, even though he did make that one comment, I think it was in around 2007, right after the song had really taken off on all of the American Idol type shows, you know, and he did sort of with a smirk on his face say to the interviewer, "Well, you know, maybe people should stop singing the song for a little while." I tend to agree with what Ratso Sloman says in our film, which is that Leonard was kidding. I think he was always incredibly touched when other artists chose to cover his work.
Also, I was talking to someone who I just met this morning. It was over at a friend's house, and she's young. She must be in her mid-20s, if that. And she said she didn't realize that, I'll paraphrase, anyone had written that song. She thought it was a song that had been around for hundreds of years. And I thought... that's something that Leonard really was looking for. He did know that a lot of his songs are timeless. And when he says in the movie, you know, I'll have a great posthumous career. This is at the low point after the rejection of that Various Positions album. In a way, he kind of knew it deep down that these were songs that would last for ages.
Right. His goal was, as he said, to write songs that would last as long as a Volvo.
That's funny. Well, he ended up playing the song well into his old age because he had to come out of, I guess, retirement because his manager stole all his money when he was at the monastery in, you know, up at the top of Mount Baldy. So he had to go on tour and he played it. And you have a lot of scenes in your movie from various concert venues all over the world. And when he plays that song, people are ecstatic.
I did my best. It wasn't much. I couldn't feel, so I learned to touch. I've told the truth. I did not come here to Coachella to fool you.
It's like being in church.
I felt that way when Dana and I went to see him perform at the Paramount Theater in Oakland, California. Dana and I live in San Francisco. When we saw the concert twice on two swings through, the entire concert felt like some sort of deep spiritual give and take. But when you get to Hallelujah, and he would get down on his knees to sing some verses and stand back up again, and this is when he's in his mid to late 70s, there's something that happened when he got to that age with all of the accrued road wear and wisdom, that it felt like some other kind of being was singing that song and giving it as a gift to the audience.
Wow, how beautiful. I wish I had seen that.
It was life-changing. I mean, I really did not appreciate who Leonard Cohen was. I walked out of that saying, you know, if there's such a thing as a Leonard Cohen deadhead, that's what I am. I had he not been at the end of that first round of tours, I think he had two or three left, I would have just put a hiatus on my job and followed him around like a Cohen head.
Well, I want to ask you about something that's not in your movie, and I'm just going to play a clip of it. Here is Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live performing Hallelujah.
Maybe I've been here before. I've seen this room and I've walked this floor. I used to live alone before I knew you. I've seen your flag on the marble arch, and love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Well, she's really actually a good singer.
She is.
So there she is. She's in character as Hillary Clinton, because this was the first show after the 2016 election and Trump had just been elected, and Leonard Cohen had also died a few days before that. So she's not actually being comic in that performance.
She wasn't. And, you know, so we actually were fortunate enough to get an interview with Kate and three of the writers that with her created that cold open. It's an incredible scene. And we're sitting there with Kate listening to her talk about why she had gone and done that song and what the song meant to her. And she started crying, and we cut together an unbelievably great scene. It dated the film a little bit too much. By the time, you know, we filmed it right in 2016 or 2017. And then by the time the film's ready to come out, 2021-22, the world had moved on. And it also made it feel very American. And Leonard was an international figure.
Mm-hmm. Well, you ended it with another Canadian, right? Katie Lang?
Yes, yes. With an incredible performance that took place in the Bell Arena in Montreal 1 year after Leonard died. It was a tribute, a memorial concert, and it's, you know, her singing a song that she's so well known for anyway.
Heard there was a secret chord David played, and it pleased the Lord. You don't really care for music, do you?
But as a memorial tribute and a moment of grieving and beauty was, it outside of that Leonard performance at the Paramount Theater that I got to see, that's the only other performance I've seen live and that had that kind of deep power and effect on me.
All right, well, let's go out on that. Katie Lang singing Hallelujah. Dan Geller and Dana Goldfein, directors of the new documentary, Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen, A Journey, A Song. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.